And now it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. Uncle Dennis here at Free Radio Santa Cruz on Thursday, the 5th of May. Viva Cinco de Mayo. I'd like to encourage you to have a pencil and paper handy so you can take notes about names, addresses, telephone numbers, web pages, anything you need to have to take action. Let's start off with announcements. River legend Mark Dubois to headline the Tuolumne River Film and Cultural Fest. It's taking place Monday, May 9th from 6:30 to 9 p.m. at the Menlo Atherton Center for the Performing Arts at 555 Middlefield Road in Atherton, California. This year's Tuolumne River Film and Culture Fest will feature Mark Dubois, a longtime environmentalist who's familiar to many on the peninsula from his stint as international co-coordinator of Earth Day in 1990, headquartered in Palo Alto. That year, more than 200 million people from 141 countries participated in the first International Earth Day celebration. Prior to that campaign, Dubois made headlines as a river advocacy legend. As co-founder and first executive director of Friends of the River, he led the campaign to save the Stanislaus River from being dammed. In 1979, he received national attention by chaining himself to a boulder in the River Canyon to prevent it from being flooded. Although this action stalled the project for a year, eventually the river was inundated by the New Melones Reservoir. Last summer, drought conditions lowered the level of the reservoir, opening up 9 miles of what was once the most popular river run on the West Coast. Dubois took his first trip down the river with others since the river was lost, and the journey was documented in a video produced by Craig Miller of KQED. Kicking off the Film and Culture Fest will be a performance by the Tuolumne River Ukulele Orchestra, followed by Last River Lost, a short documentary about the Stanislaus River campaign produced by Christian Collin of Healdsburg. The title is appropriately named as the Stanislaus campaign changed the political landscape, leading to protection of the Tuolumne and other California rivers. No major dam has been built in California since. World of Audubon 1984 Tuolumne Wild and Scenic Campaign will chronicle the campaign to save the Tuolumne River from several new dams that would have wiped out the world-class whitewater run and forced the relocation of Berkeley's Tuolumne Camp. John Amodio, Tuolumne River Trust's first executive director, will share stories about the campaign that secured federal wild and scenic status for the upper 83 miles of the Tuolumne in 1984. A Vigilant Tuolumne, produced by Lee Rogers of Menlo Park, will touch upon how the river is gaining ground with restoration, but the watershed and associated groundwater basin are under pressure. Also shown will be an excerpt from Fire Next Time, a documentary about the Yosemite Rim Fire that burned 400 square miles of the watershed in 2013, and an update on beavers and salmon by Fish Bio. Looking to the future, an excerpt from Tales of the San Joaquin, produced by Christopher Beaver of Marin, will set the stage for the next big river campaign. The San Joaquin River was recently named the second most endangered river in the United States by American Rivers, a national conservation organization. Current efforts to revive the San Joaquin and its tributaries, of which the Tuolumne is the largest, offer hope that we can bring back to life this magnificent waterway in the Bay Delta downstream. Musical acts will include original songs by Nancy Cassidy, a Palo Alto resident who was involved in the Stanislaus campaign, and Chinese melodrama, a Half Moon-based duo. Claudio Ortega and Hugo Weinzinger will sing a Spanish River ballad, and the finale will add Palo Alto-based bassist, pianist, Larry Chin, to these musicians for an audience sing-along. There will be a reception afterwards. For more information, go to www.tuolumne.org. Once again, the Tuolumne River Film and Culture Fest, Monday, May 9th from 6:30 to 9 p.m. at the Menlo Atherton Center for the Performing Arts, 555 Middlefield Road in Atherton, California. Sea Shepherd Conservation Society is offering a reward to stop attacks on monk seals in Hawaii. The Sea Shepherd Conservation Society is offering a $5,000 reward, that's a correction from last week, for any information leading to the arrest and conviction of any person or person killing or inflicting injury on any monk seal. There's an extra $5,000 reward for any information that includes video documentation of an attack by a human being on a monk seal. If you want to report an attack on a monk seal, contact NOAA Fisheries Enforcement Hotline at 1-800 1964. And for more information, go to www.cshepherd.org. The spring issue of the Earth First Journal is out, so order your EOSTAR 2016 copy today. Go to www.earthfirstjournal.org/newswire journal.org to order your copy. And the Earth First Round River Rendezvous will be held in the Great Lakes Basin this summer, taking place from June 29th through July 7th in the Manistee National Forest. For more information, go to the Earth First Journal at www.earthfirstjournal.org. And the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project turns 25 this year. Dear friends and supporters, they write, the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project is turning 25 this year. We've highlighted some of our major accomplishments from the past 25 years in our spring work report. Check out the report on our website for more details about our accomplishments, such as ecological protections that helped establish on national forests in eastern Oregon, dramatic reductions in toxic herbicide use, getting tens of thousands of acres of logging dropped, and more. Also, our spring work project report includes major updates from recent months. We could not have accomplished all of this without your support. Thank you for the wild, Karen Coulter and Paula Hood. And you can find all of this information and more at bluemountainsbiodiversityproject.org. And here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field for this week. Government hazers descended upon our soon-to-be national mammal this Monday, marking the season's first forced removal operation of West Yellowstone National Park. Agents with the Montana Department of Livestock and Fish, Wildlife, and Parks disturbed and chased 44 buffalo with about 12 newborn calves from lands west of the South Fork of the Madison in the Denny Creek area, a place buffalo love. Usually no cattle occupy these lands until mid to late June, and they are gone by October. Because of the short-term presence of cattle, these lands were excluded from the governor's last round buffalo habitat designation. Ranchers like to use the excuse of brucellosis, but the real reason buffalo are chased out of this area is because the ranchers don't want to share their grass with native buffalo. Buffalo Field Campaign patrols were out in force documenting the hazing from multiple angles. The buffalo were chased to Horse Butte, where buffalo are now safe from such abusive harassment. The buffalo were pushed at least 10 miles, with tiny calves desperately trying to keep up with their moms and the rest of the herd. When buffalo are left alone, newborn calves will take naps every 5 minutes, get up to nurse for a few moments, maybe romp around for a bit, then quickly bed down for another nap. While the hazers went at a slower pace than usual, it was still too much for these little buffalo. Hazing, no matter the pace, is always abusive. That is the nature of it, to make wildlife uncomfortable or frightened enough to leave the place of their choosing to escape the danger. During the hazing, the calves were growing more exhausted by the second. Their little legs were tiring, they were hungry, confused, and sticking close to their mothers. But the hazers wouldn't relent. Nursing breaks and naps, which were solely needed, were entirely out of the question. Surprisingly, a couple of hours into the haze, the hazers did stop for a moment. Did they actually hear our concerns? Did the buffalo reach a soft spot in their hearts? Of course not. The reason they stopped is because a couple of Yellowstone Park rangers came through to observe. The rangers just drove by saying, "Nice and slow, that's what we like to see," and went on their way. As soon as they were out of sight, the cowboy tactics resumed. The rangers will likely report that the haze was going well, but our footage will be able to show the truth of what really took place. It's hard to know, but we hope this first haze will also be the last of the season. The buffalo haze this week were part of the first large group to venture to this part of the basin this spring. In years past, it was not uncommon to see between 400 and 600 buffalo, while currently there are barely 200. Fearing the worst, I called Yellowstone's bison biologist to confirm that management actions and winter kill had taken a heavy toll on the central herd, but he indicated that there were also some unusual weather patterns this year that may have contributed to so few buffalo being in the Hebgen Basin, changes that led the buffalo to use the landscape differently than we normally see. The Buffalo Field Campaign's website is at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org, and there you can find all this information and more. And please remember that the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And the California Department of Fish and Wildlife has delayed spotted owl listing decision in this story by Rob DiPerna of the Environmental Protection Information Center. The California Fish and Game Commission, the regulatory body responsible for the administration of the California Endangered Species Act, has decided to delay its decision on whether or not listing the northern spotted owl is warranted until its next regularly scheduled meeting to be convened in June in Bakersfield. The three-person commission panel voted unanimously to delay rendering a final determination on whether or not the listing of a critically imperiled spotted owl is warranted, in favor of directing the California Department of Fish and Wildlife to begin the process of developing a stakeholder working group to address the management needs for the fast-disappearing species. The commission's decision to delay comes on the heels of almost universal agreement at its April 14, 2016 meeting among a broad array of stakeholders that provided testimony, all of which clearly indicates that the northern spotted owl is in peril in California and that additional management actions are likely necessary to prevent the extinction of the species in the short term. However, instead of determining that the listing is warranted on the basis of insurmountable mountain of rigorous scientific evidence showing that the owl is in trouble, the commission chose to defer to the concerns of the timber industry over the possible additional regulatory constraints that would result from the listing of the owl under the California Endangered Species Act, despite the fact that the act of listing itself does not actually result in any change in regulation on the timber industry. Astoundingly, during commission deliberations, the president of the Fish and Game Commission, Eric Sklar, all but acknowledged that the plain language of the law likely compelled the commission to make a warranted determination on the listing petition, but instead of doing so, Sklar and the commission decided to defer to the interests of the people that would supposedly be adversely affected by the listing determination economically. The CESA listing of a species as threatened or endangered did not automatically result in regulatory changes to any industry sector or entity that may be adversely affected by the habitat of a listed species. Any actual regulation changes that could potentially affect private lands forestry operations must be fully noticed, vetted, and adopted by the California Board of Forestry and Fire Protection, an entity that is in no way beholden to change anything simply as a result of a warranted listing determination under CESA for any species, the spotted owl included. The Commission's decision to delay making a final listing determination on EPIC's petition for the northern spotted owl comes in the wake of a series of delays, legal and otherwise, perpetuated by both the Commission itself, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, that have stymied the listing process for nearly 4 years now, despite overwhelming and compelling evidence that the spotted owl is in rapid and precipitous declines in California and elsewhere, and that the rate of decline is increasing, with a veritable laundry list of stressors and threats confounding management, conservation, and recovery of the species in the wild. The Commission will again take up the question of whether or not listing of the northern spotted owl is warranted at its June 23, 2016 meeting in Bakersfield, California. The Environmental Protection Information staff are diligently preparing and will be present in hopes of persuading the Commission to act to list the spotted owl in accordance with the standards of applicable California law. For more information, go to www.wildcalifornia.org. And a landmark win has been obtained against hydro dams in Brazil in this story from Intercontinental Cry. In a landmark victory for indigenous land rights in Brazil, the National Foundation for the Indians, FUNAI, has decided to proceed with the official demarcation and protection of the Mundurucu people's 700-square-mile ancestral territory on the Tapajós River in the Brazilian Amazon. The land demarcation is a major political win for the Mundurucu peoples. Under existing Brazilian legislation, the construction of hydroelectric plants that flood demarcated indigenous lands is expressly prohibited. This means that the Mundurucu's historical territory must now be spared from the same dam-driven destruction witnessed in the Zungu region since construction began on the controversial Belo Monte Dam project. The recent move by Funai also sets a new legal milestone for indigenous peoples demanding land demarcation as a way to protect their territories. Funai, the Brazilian acronym for Fundação Nacional de Indio, announced the decision to demarcate the Munduruku's territory on the Day of Indigenous Peoples, April 19th, 2016. Acting in his official capacity as the government body responsible for establishing and carrying out policies related to indigenous peoples, the institution published documents identifying and recognizing the Munduruku's ancestral rights to Saure Muibu, the territory of 178,000 hectares located between Itatuba and Tarao in the state of Pará. Funai's decision to demarcate ends a long-standing and heated political battle between Brazil's energy sector and indigenous peoples in the Tapajós. For at least the last 5 years, the energy sector insisted that no indigenous peoples had ancestral ties to the region. Funai's announcement brings an end to that argument, confirming that the Munduruku have historical ties to the dam-threatened area. The final demarcation still depends upon a presidential decree that cannot be established for 90 days, a normative time frame to allow questions and debate to take place. Nevertheless, the Munduruku territory is now all but secured from the consequences of São Luís do Tapajós Dam. The dam carried an estimated cost of $32.52 billion about $9 billion American dollars, which would have generated on average 4 megawatts of power per year, about the same as the Belo Monte Dam, also in the state of Pará. On its own, San Luis de Tapajós Dam would provide almost half the energy of all the other hydroelectric plants planned in Brazil for the next 10 years, supporting over 20 million homes. Yet its environmental and human cost was brutal. The São Luís de Tapajós Dam would not only take the Munduruku's ancestral lands, the total flood area would encompass 729 square kilometers of pristine Amazon rainforest. To put things in perspective, the Belo Monte Dam was only set to flood 503 square kilometers. Like the Belo Monte Dam, the São Luís de Tapajós Dam has been constantly entangled in judicial irregularities and corruption scandals. In 2014, Brazil's government announced the dam without an environmental license, a fatal move that forced the government to cancel planning a couple of days later. When a judge ordered Funai to expedite land demarcation in the affected area, the federal government in Brasilia overturned the ruling, claiming there was no need for demarcation. The government stakes are high, placing considerable pressure on the then-director of Funai, Maria Augusta Acirati, to uphold the process of land demarcation. Before quitting Funai, she admitted in a meeting with Munduruku authorities that she was expected to secure the Hydro Dam's interests. Funai held back the land demarcation for years. In 2016, the dam project was placed on the market once again, the government repeating its past failure to carry out a free, prior, and informed consultation with the Munduruku, as required by the Convention 169 of the International Labor Organization. For more information, go to www.intercontinentalcry.org. And elephant poachers have killed rangers, wounding a Swedish park manager in the Congo. In this story by Marine Panettiere, editing by Andrew Heavens, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Elephant poachers killed 3 rangers in the Democratic Republic of Congo's Garamba Wildlife Park and wounded 2 other people, including the Swedish park manager, environmental officials said. One of the rangers was found dead near the site of the Saturday attack, said African Parks, which manages the UNESCO World Heritage Site. U.S. forces in the area evacuated the others, but 2 of them died of their injuries a day later at a military base in neighboring Central African Republic, the organization added. The survivors were in a stable condition. Rangers put their lives on the line each and every day and are under real siege in the Garamba, protecting elephants from heavily incentivized and militarized poaching gangs, African Parks Chief Executive Peter Fernhead said in a statement. Armed poachers killed 3 Congolese soldiers and 5 guards from the State Wildlife Authority in 3 separate incidents in Garamba in 2015. Africa's elephant population is estimated to have dwindled by 60% over the past decade, and around 30,000 elephants are poached every year, largely to supply ivory to Asian countries, said the campaigners. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife plans to kill all 16 of Wyoming's Dell Creek wolf pack in this story by Melody Edwards, Wyoming Public Media, as found on the Earth First Newswire. A wolf pack in western Wyoming has been evading the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service after killing as many as 10 cattle this past winter. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Wolf Coordinator Mike Jimenez says efforts to reduce the pack size failed to stop livestock killing, and now the plan is to kill all 16 wolves in the pack. He says it's the second wolf pack in the area to cause problems. Last month, another pack killed 19 adult elk at a feeding ground. Jimenez says the problem is wolf populations have filled up all the more remote areas where they conflict less with people. Now they've expanded into some of these marginal areas that are on the interface, if you will, between forest and ranch land, and those kind of areas are not suitable for wolves. Tell that to the wolves. Jimenez says they've been using aerial gunning to shoot the wolves, but the animals have learned to hide in the trees at the sound of the planes arriving. Yeah, wolves are pretty smart, he says. We usually use aerial gunning is how we do it, and wolves aren't any different than any other animal. A plane comes over and wolves pick up on that and are aware of it, and if they're not in the trees, they head for the trees. He says it's a priority to kill the remaining 11 wolves in the Dell Creek pack because ranchers are in the midst of calving in the area. Jimenez says livestock killing by wolves is pretty rare. He says they use aerial gunning since the species is still protected as endangered and can't be hunted to control their numbers. And this story was found at www.earthfirstjournal.org/newswire. Ontario, Canada. Hundreds of mink have been released from a fur farm in this story by Rabbit, as found in Bite Back on the Earth First Newswire. In the early hours of April 30th, over 500 mink were released from their cages at Willow Pond Farm in Ontario, Bite Back reported. This act of animal liberation comes about 6 months after the release of undercover footage from the same fur farm. That footage, released by the Animal Liberation Front in October of 2015, shows seemingly endless rows of caged mink. The communique that accompanied the video says that ALF members witnessed injured mink with gaping wounds crammed into small cages that were covered in dirt and feces at the Willow Pond Mink Farm. The posting of the footage online followed a string of mink liberations and other animal-related direct actions in Ontario in 2015. You can read more about these actions in the article Ontario, Canada, Escalation and Underground Action Against the Fur Industry, found in the Earth First Journal Yule Edition 2015, page 44. And a blockade has disrupted Klamath watershed salvage logging in this story by Dan Bacher from Intercontinental Cry. In the early morning hours before daybreak on May 2nd, in the fire-impacted conifer forest near Sade Valley in the Klamath River watershed, 27 people, including tribal youth, river advocates, and forest activists, blocked the road leading to the Klamath National Forest West Side Salvage Logging Project. Demonstrators held banners that read "Kuruk Land, Kuruk Plan," recited call and response chants, and testified to the timber sales impact upon ailing salmon population. Work was delayed for approximately 4 hours, according to a news release from the River Advocates. The protesters said the Westside Salvage Logging Project would clear more than 5,700 acres on steep slopes above the Klamath River tributaries and along 320 miles of roads within the Klamath National Forest. Post-fire logging and hauling began in late April before legal claims brought forth by a lawsuit led by the Kuruk tribe could be considered in court. The Forest Service should follow the Kuruk plan on Kuruk land. Traditional knowledge of fire helps everything stay in balance because it's all intertwined, said Dania Rose Colgrove of the Klamath Justice Coalition. When you destroy the forest, you destroy the rivers. The protesters said the West Side plan, unlike the Kuruk alternative, calls for clear-cut logging on steep slopes right above several of the Klamath River's most important salmon-bearing streams at a time when returning salmon numbers are reaching record lows. Members of local tribal youth councils who participated in the protests see West Side salvage logging as a threat to their future. Today I showed up and stood up for what is right for my future generation, said Lacey Jackson, a 16-year-old Hoopa Tribal Youth Council member. My cultural and traditional livelihood is being threatened, and the way they are going about this logging is a big part of that. I will continue to stand up for me, my people, and future generations. River advocates say the Forest Service plan to clear-cut thousands of acres above the Klamath River disregards a reasonable, correct alternative and hurts at-risk salmon and river communities. They believe a healthy Klamath River requires sensible forest restoration that addresses the needs of both fish and people, like that laid out in the correct plan. Federal and state fisheries agency scientists estimated that there were only approximately 142,200 Klamath River Fall Run Chinook salmon in the ocean this year, based on the returns of two-year-old salmon called Jacks and Jills. The salmon from the Klamath and Sacramento River make up the majority of salmon taken in California's ocean and inland fisheries. The low number of Klamath and Trinity River fish expected to return to the river and tributaries this year will result in more restricted seasons for both recreational and commercial fisheries in the ocean and recreational and tribal fisheries in the rivers this season. During a meeting of the Klamath Dam removal in Sacramento in March, Thomas Wilson, a member of the Yurok Tribal Council and owner of Spagee Point Guide Service, described the dire situation that the salmon fishery is in this year. The season will be devastating for fishermen and people on the river. Usually we get around 12,000 fish for subsistence on the river, and what's left goes to the commercial fishery. This year our entitled tribal quota is only about 5,900 fish, she explained. The people are praying that the science predicting the low numbers is wrong. If we don't protect the fish now, it will hurt us down the road. As Yuroks and natives, we are conservationists. We want to make sure enough seed is kept for all the resources of future generations, Wilson said. The last thing that the watershed needs at a time when the fishery is in crisis is a Forest Service-approved cutting plan that further threatens salmon and steelhead habitat. If you need more information, go to www.intercontinentalcry.org. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is broadcast every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org. You can hear a rebroadcast of this show tomorrow afternoon, Fridays at 3 p.m. If you are in the Moscow, Idaho area, listen to KRFP Radio Free Moscow at 90.3 FM on 3 p.m. on Wednesdays. In Boston, WZBC Radio Truth and Justice Radio Show at 90.3 FM broadcasts the Earth First Update between 6 and 10 a.m. on Sundays. Grateful Dread Public Radio and Internet Radio Station broadcasts the Earth First Update Sundays at 2 a.m. Go to gdprnashville.org. And you can always go to radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4.net, where you can listen online and download this or previous Earth First updates. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First update every week. It's free to download and broadcast. This is Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening to this week's Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced at Free Radio Santa Cruz. Thank you for listening, and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.